accession number 20937, Reel 3.
Neville Howell, Reel 3.
Yes, we were out with the under the command of the battery captain to improve our driving skills, and we spotted these people in the trenches crouching down, and inevitably we found we were in the wrong place because we heard gunfire and shells started bursting among our vehicles. The battery captain gave hurried signals to turn around, and off we chased in the opposite direction, and again the people in the trenches were waving their fists. We'd obviously brought fire down on their area, and they weren't very pleased about it, understandably. Yes, that was one thing. I can remember some of the actions which we were committed to take part in. One of them in particular was we were supposed to go down into what was a valley, if you like, and we were going to take part in an attack on a part of the German line. Having captured that part of the German line, the whole column of tanks and infantry and ourselves would turn right and roll up that line. All looked very nice. We were fairly green, and so we thought everything would go according to plan. We went down past through the Australian positions just as it was getting light in the morning to take up our positions in this valley. And my particular position was the extreme right of the valley, so that when the attack took place, assuming it went according to plan and we turned right, I would then find that I would be heading part of the column, rolling up the German line. Well, that is our battery anti-tank guns got down into this valley and were spread out along it. Mine was extreme right-hand position. And eventually the tanks who were going to lead the attack on the line itself came through us, went over the top of the opposite side of the valley, if you like, and they immediately came under fire from the German lines, which were about 200 yards away. And the tanks, lots of our tanks, were being knocked out and burning. And we could look back along the length of this valley. We could see German tank crews coming back, crawling. Shells were falling in the valley itself. And now, for the first time, myself and my crew were receiving quite a lot of attention, possibly because we were at the extreme right-hand end of this little valley. And we took shelter underneath the vehicle, our, if you like, portee, two-pounded portee. One of my members was, one of my crew was Jewish. His name was Landy. And we joked that if we were taken prisoner, that he should only give his army rank and number, but not his name. And yes, we, if you like, now became, what can I say, battle experienced, in that we were, even though under shellfire, we were able to joke. This was forced humour, if you like, but anything which detracted from being afraid, if you like. And this type of humour we discovered, we were discovering for the first time, and this is the type of thing which would serve us, and I'm sure lots of other people will in the future. We were able to laugh at situations of that nature. When these shells were bursting around us, fortunately, there was quite a bit of soft sand, and we didn't come to any harm in particular, I received two very small fragments from a shell burst, one in each leg, landing on the nose, of all places. They were only very, very tiny bits. In fact, I was able to... We wore what were called... they were a type of footless sock on the leg. I forget for the moment what the name of those things were. But anyway, these small fragments had penetrated this item of clothing and lodged in the leg, nut deep, and I was able to, when I rolled my... Oh, they were called hose tops, these pieces. When I rolled them down, one came away at the time, although it just penetrated the skin, broke the skin, and the other one I was able to get that out myself quite easily. And but the only thing is, any breaks in the skin, and we all, obviously everybody in the desert got broken skin on your hands and that type of thing, they tended not to heal up, and I had a similar thing with these small places on my legs, if you like. They would not heal up until we left the desert, and that's a long while afterwards. But yes, this action was a complete failure, if you like. Eventually, the battery Don R came roaring up to my position, shouted across, everybody, every man for himself, get out how you can. Get out. So that was the situation. It was really very bad. We got out okay.
Where
the battery had received some of its first casualties. And yes, so that was the end of that. I believe we heard afterwards that the brigadier in charge of that particular thing had been given the order of the boot.
Where and when was this?
This is all part of the Alamein position, part of the Alamein line, if you like.
Do you know roughly the date?
I would go for July or August.
42.
42, yeah. I forgot to mention that when I joined this anti-tank regiment in England, we were part of what was known as the 8th Armoured Division, whose sign was a G-O on a green background. And we were known as the Go Boys. That was the sign, G-O, Go. Somebody decided it was more like a traffic light, the green of a traffic light with a Go on it. And we were known as the Go Boys. That was one of the nicknames, if you like, attached to people who had that sign on the shoulders. When we arrived in Egypt, it was decided that the division would be disbanded and the armoured brigades would act and become independent. And my regiment, now we have got no division, it was decided that we would become what are known as corps troops, and we were now corps anti-tank, which meant we could be and would be sent to serve with anybody, anywhere, anytime, any regiment, anywhere, any division. And this was the type of thing we kept right through. This was the situation we kept. We were 30 corps troops, and we kept that situation right through to the end of the war. But that's just by the way. Another thing I can... We took part in many actions, if you like. Some of them at night time. Another incident I can remember is... And this was during the day. We were digging into a new position not far from the coast road in the Alamein position. Early in the morning, heard a bit of fire coming from behind us, and sure enough, there was a German Messerschmitt flying along the coast road, just above the coast road, if you like. People were firing at it with machine guns, but as per usual, you can say 100% of the stuff was going behind the plane. He was out of action. And he put it down on the coast road itself. The pilot made it an extremely good job. He put it down on the coast road itself, belly landing, no undercarriage, slid along the coast road and came to a stop about 100 yards from where I was. Went across to the plane, along with a lot of other people who were going there as well. And the young pilot slid back the hood, sat on top of the fuselage with his legs still presumably on his seat inside the cockpit. He took a comb from his pocket and sat there combing his hair, this young pilot. And he also, his machine guns were still smoking. There was still a little bit of smoke coming from them. He'd obviously used them somewhere. And he waved us away from the front of the where they were, the machine guns were smoking. So in case, I presume, there was still ammunition there that might explode or go off or whatever. Yes. And and I thought what a cool customer he was. He, like we say, he sat there, he combed his hair and put his comb away again and waited until a truck came across from somewhere and picked him up and took him off. And I went back to what we were doing, digging a gun pit. Mm. That was one thing. my troop, which is, consists of four guns, if you like, in the troop, still 2-pounders. We hadn't been equipped with the new 6-pounders. Were given a task of occupying a thin ridge of ground next to what was called the Ruizet position. This was some strips of very high ground in the Alamein area. We had to occupy this one finger, thin finger of high ground going leading out into no man's land. I was, because it was impossible to deploy the guns in width as we would normally have done, 2 up front and 2 behind, about 700 yards behind, covering the rear, if you like. We weren't able to deploy in the normal manner. We had to deploy, because of the nature of the terrain, one behind the other. So there would be 4 guns spaced about 700 yards apart, one behind the other. I was selected to occupy the front gun pit, which was enclosed. That particular position was enclosed by wire and occupied. The infantry on that position were Gurkhas. Obviously, they'd been selected for that position because of this. It was the most advanced position. The gun pit was already there. It'd been blown, a hole had been blown in the rocky ground, if you like. Trenches couldn't be built, so the infantry were occupying, these Gurkhas were occupying what were called sangars. These, you pick up bits of stone and build a shelter from stone, if you like. We were told that, and they were expecting a German attack at the time, or enemy attack at the time, we were told that anybody retreating through that wire would be fired on by our own troops. Obviously, that type of thing, there would be no danger of the Gurkhas retiring. We knew their reputation, but that applied to us, of course. So the other thing was, inside that wire were 3 Italian guns with loads of ammunition stacked beside them. They'd been captured. And the other thing is, the gun pit I was occupying, the previous gun crew in that pit with the 2-pounder gun had been taken prisoner. The Germans had got into that position during the night, before, that was before the Gurkhas were occupying it, and they'd spirited the gun crew away. The Gurkhas used to go out on patrol from that position in their gym shoes, if you like, go off. They would go off in the evening and try to make it back before it got light. And obviously, their jobs were to try to pick up a prisoner and that type of thing. I can remember one occasion they didn't come back, so we used to look for them going out and coming back. They didn't come back. No, they didn't make it. They were pinned down for the rest of the day. They were pinned down without any shelter from the sun. And they did get back that next evening. That evening they got back. The other thing was the Stukas used to come over. We saw them fairly often. They seemed to come almost on with the clock, about 7 o'clock in the evening. A load of Stukas would fly past and drop some bombs. And then they were dropping a bit nearer. And on one particular evening, these Stukas came over. There was only about 5 or 6 of them. We watched them coming. And then they turned and came starting to dive straight towards that particular position. We had a sangar in which we took cover. And they were coming. I actually saw the before we actually dived in there, we saw them coming down on us. They had their sirens howling, if you like, very low. You could actually see the crewman, the pilot, and you could see the bomb released, the main bomb released from them. We hit the deck inside there, one on top of the other inside a Sanger. Fortunately, what I was afraid of was that they were going to hit the ammunition stacked alongside these Italian guns, if you like. But fortunately, the bombs just cleared us and went into the dip on the other side of us, where there were some Indian troops, if you like, as opposed to Gurkhas. There were some people from the, I think it was the 4th Indian Division. They were Sikhs and that type of thing. And the bombs fell amongst them, which was only about 100 yards or so to our right and off this high base ground. And, so we escaped that. And I remember we had a brain gun, and one of my crew had picked up the brain gun. It was already had a mag on it. And they pulled out, and as they'd come in from our left, if you like, they turned right, turned left towards us and dived down, and then they turned left again to go back to their own lines. And this chap, my bomb crew, opened fire on them. Now they'd all dropped the bombs, he was firing at the last one away, if you like, and you could see the pilot and the man sitting behind the pilot quite plainly, and I still remember what the bloke behind the pilot looked like. He was a toady-faced looking individual looking down at us. Whilst the tracers was going to the rear, I felt like grabbing that gun, but, you know, redirecting it. But that seemed to be a common thing with people who were using machine guns to fire at aircraft. Any time, most of the stuff seemed to go behind. Anyway, after I left that position, I was given 4 days leave in Alexandria. Presumably they thought I needed a rest, because that position was a bit difficult to move around during daylight. We were under observation all the time, if you like. So yes, I was given a 4 day leave with a couple of other people from the battery to Alexandria. And passed very pleasantly. 4 days of freedom, if you like, to rest up, to drink, do what you like. And then back to the regiment. The regiment had, by the time I went back after that 4 day leave, had all been withdrawn, well, my battery certainly had, to re-equip with 6-pounder anti-tank guns. And yes, we re-equipped. Okay, that was easy enough for me because I knew the gun. And about this time, Montgomery came out and took charge. I must say, Field Marshal Montgomery came out and took charge. Previous to that, we'd been under command when we initially went out under Auchinleck. And then whoever it was took over from him, I forget now, off the top of my head. But then Monty came out around that time and took charge of the whole affair. And German advance, they were expected to attack any time. And Monty decided to, along with his planning staff, of course, to form a box backed onto the coast so that if the Germans did advance, we would be in a tight box. And we would deny them that particular area and we'd be able to punish them on the flank. In this position, yes, our anti-tank guns from my battery were scattered around in this position. Normally, you can say the distance between anti-tank guns was about 500 or 700 yards, and they would be scattered in depth so that we'd have a line in front and a line of anti-tank guns behind. Yes, I was in a forward position, and just below a small ridge. And yes, the Germans decided to put in their big attack. I suppose the nearest they were to me would have been half a mile away, their part. Our artillery was very busy, of course, punishing the German column of advance. I was able to look over the top of this low ridge where I was positioned, and I could see where most of the activity was taking place. At night time, German bombers tended to operate individually. I'd seen them previously. Nuisance bombing, if you like. Nuisance. They were low, and I noticed on a few occasions that you could actually see when they released the bombs. There was a spark underneath the aircraft of some sort. I don't know what it was. Presumably some kind of electrical detachment of the bomb. And most of the bombs that they did drop were anti-personnel. They were the type of thing where a bomb, like a big case, would open in the air and scatter a lot of small bomblets. I often thought it would be very unpleasant to be caught by something like that. On this one night, yes, this aircraft came over the top, and just before it got to us, I saw the spark underneath it, and you could actually hear the bomb coming down. Fortunately, it was not the type which opened and dropped a load of small bomblets. Fortunately, I say that, and the bomb actually landed about a metre and a half from the side of my gun pit. By then, we were all flat in the bottom of the gun pit. I myself was between the trails of the six-pounder legs, the trail legs of the six-pounder. There was a hell of a blast. Hell of a blast. But we were not physically harmed. People from the rear came across to see if we were all right. They obviously observed where the bomb had dropped and thought that we'd really caught it. What type of bomb it was, I do not know, because I suspect it was a practice bomb that was used. The reason I'm saying that is that we could actually see where the centre of the blast was, but the whole area was scattered, including some bits in the gun pit, and on the far side of the gun pit from where the bomb had landed were all pieces like melamine that you use on tabletops and that type of thing. That was brown, but it was scattered everywhere. So presumably the idea was that if it fell among personnel, they were all sharp, lots of sharp pieces, large and small bits, that the blast would, and these bits and pieces would cut into you. We weren't hurt. It was amazing, but we were not hurt, considering the thing fell so close. Apart from the blast, and it was a blast, and I think it was a practice bomb. For whatever reason, would have dropped it. But it was nothing else apart from that. There was just these bits and pieces. So the whole thing, I mean, we didn't see any pieces of metal as such. There was just a scattering hundreds of these pieces, large and small. Yes, anyway, so we were lucky. Yeah, my crew and I were lucky, very lucky, that it wasn't a different type of bomb.
Well, this is when you had to face this German attack.
This German attack went through. It'd be difficult to just describe verbally what happened, but yes, the German line was here. Here's the sea. We formed a box here. The Germans attacked here towards, if you like, open to get to Cairo that way. So they were getting hammered on the flank all the time. There were, our line had extended to the south, so yes, we had people down there as well. Here was a stopgap of some of the newer tanks, our own newer tanks. They were General Grant tanks, the ones with two fairly heavy guns on board, two heavy guns, not one, one in the turret and one on the side. And that was the furthest the Germans got. They lost a lot of tanks. They'd been punished all the way by artillery and air, from the air. And eventually, of course, they had to, what was left of them, had to withdraw and go back. That was the last big German advance before what is popularly known as the Battle of Alamein, if you like, our advance.
What part did you play in that?
In what? In the German?
In the countering that German attack.
Nothing except that I was in position there in case they... To prevent them, if you like, that box was where we held a lot of troops, and yes, that was there to punish them from that flank. And yes, obviously we didn't open up with our anti-tank guns because you keep quiet with an anti-tank gun. You don't fire unless you absolutely have to, because once your position is given away, and so obviously German tanks in attack, I don't want to go into the technicalities of tanks and anti-tank guns, but tanks are always very careful when they're advancing in case there is a camouflaged anti-tank position, and so they can't rush forward at their maximum speed. They have to creep along, because sooner or later they're likely to bump and find that they hit a concealed position containing an anti-tank gun, which is, of course, anyway, yes, perhaps more of that later. It came to the time when the main Battle of Alamein would take place, which was going to be our advance. We were not, and again, I don't want to talk about the regiment, because we didn't see much of the other of our regiment. We were, as I pointed out before, scattered about. Part of the regiment could be with one division, part of the regiment with another division, and hence miles apart. But our battery were not required for the first night of our own big attack. I almost said British attack, but of course there were Australians, there were New Zealanders, there were Indians, there were other people involved. And yes, it all looked, we were fully informed, if you like. I think it was one of the great things with Montgomery, that he believed in passing back as much information as he could down to the troops on the ground via their various commanders. And we were not required for the initial attack, which was taking place at night time.
Which battery was yours?
Which battery was I? At that time, it was 104/111 battery. Right. And, yes, the battery commander, White, the battery sergeant major, was Twisty Turner. That neither here nor there. But we weren't required at the opening of the attack at night time. This was the time that I suppose a lot of people remember hearing about it, even if they didn't take part, when all the, close to, I think, 1,000 guns opened up and that type of thing. We were held behind the line. We wouldn't want to clattered up unnecessarily the closer parts to where the attack took place. But yes, we moved up the next day and to the line itself. And I remember being on a very dusty track at one point. A forward field hospital had been set up near there, in tents, of course. And at one part of this track where we came to a standstill, because there was a lot of vehicles, it was dark, there was a lot of gunfire, and when there's a lot of artillery fire and shells bursting, they tend to kick up a lot of dust from the ground. Where tracks have been used time and time again, it became so powdery that it almost slopped about like water on the ground, and it soon came up off the ground and filled the air. And yes, there was a lot of gunfire from our own and from the Germans. There were a lot of shell bursts here and there. And yes, the whole place was, the whole, I suppose, front line was covered in smoke and dust. But we stopped near on a part of this track. I was pulled up for most of the night. It was a cold night. And there was a guy on the ground, looked like an Australian because he had a bush hat on. He was obviously dead. And by the end of the night, he was so covered in dust, he looked like somebody who'd been sculpted from sand. If somebody says to me, well, why didn't somebody do something about it? Well, they can't be very familiar with our battle conditions, if you like. There are several reasons why you don't do something about it, but one of them being that the Germans, if you like, had a habit of booby-trapping bodies as well as anything else. So there was a tendency to leave things like that for people who were assigned that job. In any case, ambulances were trundling past, and This was on the second night of the big battle of Alamein, if you like. The next day, I watched as some parts of my battery were ordered forward, a little further forward, to take up positions. I saw two of them go up on mines, these mines exploding, and my troop was shuttled off to a different part. Again, we stayed with our guns